I'm Adrian Finnegan, and this is Counting the Cost on Al Jazeera, your weekly look at the world of business and economics. This week, the growing number of strikes and labour protests is threatening industries all over the world. But is the cost of living crisis causing the pay crisis, or are governments failing to tackle inflation? Also this week, China has been battling a record number of coronavirus infections, but fury is growing over its strict virus curbs. So will the zero COVID policy continue, and at what cost to China's economy? Plus, we take a ride aboard the transport of the future. Flying taxis are expected to be zipping through the skies in the not too distant future. Energy, food and mortgage costs are at their highest in decades in many countries, and the rising cost of living is eating into workers' wages. This means that many people are forced to cut spending or run down their savings. Others, who are less privileged, are going without food. Rapidly rising prices have already pushed more than 70 million people into poverty, mainly in the developing world, while at least one in four people is struggling financially in the developed world. Employees across the globe are downing tools and are demanding better pay deals that keep up with inflation. Among them are workers at Amazon across 40 countries who walked off the job during the Black Friday sales, one of the busiest days of the year for online shopping. The strike included employees in Britain, which has seen a series of protests disrupting train travel, mail deliveries and aviation services. And more strikes are planned in the run-up to the Christmas holiday period, including nurses for the first time. Workers squeezed by the soaring cost of energy have protested across Europe. Trades unions representing more than 800,000 public servants protested over pay outside hospitals, ports and at government buildings in South Africa. Peruvian truck drivers and farmers blocked roads as part of ongoing protests over high gas prices and a shortage of fertiliser. And truck drivers in South Korea have gone on strike too, their second in less than 6 months, and it's disrupted supply chains across the country. Now, let's hear what some of the workers who went on strike had to say.
With the small amount of money or salary that you earn, you can't live in this time. I have three children, and we both work, and we have a huge problem because the costs have risen so enormously that you can't live with what you earn.
Everything is expensive. I cannot afford anything. I cannot afford to take my kids to school anymore. It's too much.
We haven't had a decent pay for over a decade now. Nurses work really hard, not just nurses, the NHS. We're all under pressure at the moment. Everyone's working their heads off. Really, really difficult. So it's not just about clapping for us during the pandemic. I think we need to be respected and appreciated for what we do.
Joining us now from London is Ximena Blanco, Research Director and Head of America's Risk Insights at Verisk Maplecroft. Good to have you with us again, Ximena. From truck drivers to teachers, nurses to train drivers, there seems to be a lot of industrial action around at the moment. Are we seeing a revival in labour activism and in unions?
Well, I think what we're seeing right now is the reaction to the cost of living crisis and people taking what would be more extreme measures in demand for pay rises. And of course, you know, what we're noticing now is in developed economies, in emerging markets, labor activism never went away if you look at countries that have been struggling with inflation for many years. But what we're now seeing is in Western Europe, in the United States, that workers are facing double-digit inflation, and this is something that hasn't happened for decades. And this, you know, these strikes you're talking about is just a symptom of the economic situation that families are dealing with day in and day out.
But are strikes effective? They come at a cost not only for the workers who are striking, but customers, consumers too. They tend to have an impact on goodwill, don't they?
Yes, absolutely. They have an impact on the economy. And overall, I mean, of course, we also have to take into account that certain parts of the economy can continue operating despite strikes, because we, of course, have a very digital economies in parts of the activities. But that, of course, you know, doesn't apply to areas like you were mentioning, say, for example, healthcare, where, you know, people need to physically be present to treat patients. Now, a key thing to keep in mind is that the legislation in developed economies incentivizes dialogue, but it doesn't force dialogue and it doesn't force conciliatory solutions as it does in some emerging markets. And so I think what we're going to continue seeing is this discussion where workers are demanding for something, but industry chambers are not necessarily responding or sitting down at the table in the same way that we would see in emerging markets, where legislation forces consensus to be reached in order to resolve labor disputes.
We're in the midst of a cost of living crisis. There's no end of insight to adjust. How much worse can things get? I mean, there in London in particular, where you are, they're talking about the nation suffering another winter of discontent, the likes of which haven't been seen since the 1970s.
Of course. And, you know, I think the crucial thing to look out for, the signpost we all need to watch, is energy costs and what happens not just in the UK, but in Europe overall in terms of energy security during this winter. The UK, of course, is suffering a lot of strikes. But, you know, this week I was traveling for business. I was traveling on an airline that was striking in Spain. I was on a rail strike in Belgium. There were, you know, there are postal strikes in the UK at the moment. So this is not something affecting just one nation or one sector. And the cost of fuel is feeding into all of this. What happens with the war, Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and the impact that that has on the cost of living will be crucial. A resolution to the conflict, which at the moment we consider unlikely in the short term, we assign a 16% probability to that happening by March, that would be something that removes pressure from the inflationary cycle that we're in. But unfortunately, we have not seen the peak of inflation in Europe quite yet, and things could get slightly worse before they begin to improve.
People are understandably angry with their governments, but to a certain extent, governments are stuck between a rock at a hard place, aren't they, right now? Whatever they do, it's going to upset someone, with the cost of living, as you say, so high due to things that are out of their control.
Yes, well, I mean, one thing that governments can look into is segmented policy decisions, because one of the biggest mistakes governments can make, and we have seen it in different countries around the world, is, for example, blanket measures, say blanket tax increases or blanket subsidies to specific items like fuel. And if the hardest part is not necessarily designing the policy to address the cost of living crisis for the most vulnerable, the hardest part is implementing it in a way that makes it a temporary solution, but one that's easy to lift once economies begin recovering. Because, of course, we're now facing the potential for recession across Western Europe as well, in conjunction with inflation. And that is quite a concerning picture for people who are not being able to make ends meet.
But these are extraordinary times. Are people right to demand that their salaries should rise along with the cost of living, along with inflation?
Well, I think there isn't a one-answer-fits-all kind of response from the private sector or from governments. The first thing that we need to look at is the people on the lower end of the income spectrum, the vulnerable incomes, who are feeling the hit of inflation most. And I think, you know, low salaries, basic salaries, minimum wage will need to be adjusted for inflation, because those are the households that are in working poverty, and more households are entering that category right now. Whereas it's a different situation when we're looking at, you know, the middle class or high income wages that are less likely to rise at the same rate. And again, you know, if we were to apply a blanket approach to incomes across the board, that in itself is an inflationary pressure that could keep prices rising faster as companies need to adjust for the price of the goods and services that they sell in the economy.
And generally, we've been talking about the impact this is having on people living in richer, developed countries. What about countries and people in the developing world?
Well, the double whammy of the pandemic followed by the cost of living crisis is increasing poverty and inequality across emerging markets. We have seen it across Latin America and sub-Saharan Africa as well. Households are struggling, and the most vulnerable, not just in terms of income, but also minority groups, are those suffering the most, with women across many of these countries taking an additional burden or additional hit in terms of having to care for relatives or take additional jobs or being able not to get help that they would need in order to progress in the workforce. And so this, you know, the double impact of the pandemic and the cost of living crisis is going to be in those generations for some years to come.
Hemina, it's always great to have you on Counting the Cost. Thank you very much indeed for being with us again.
Thank you.
Well, rising food prices and record high inflation are making life more difficult for people in Zimbabwe. The country is facing a hunger crisis, and poor harvests have left more than 3 million people in need of help. International aid agencies have started to deliver food to vulnerable families there, as Haru Matasa reports from Buhera.
It hasn't rained much in this part of Zimbabwe for several months. This food from international aid agencies is appreciated. People here in Buhera say they sometimes have to borrow money to feed their families.
And what it often means is that people will eat fewer meals, they will eat less food, they will prioritize within the family who gets meals and who doesn't get meals. And they may also resort to other coping strategies. So it's not an easy time when you're among those vulnerable households in rural areas in Zimbabwe.
This time of the year is always challenging in Zimbabwe's drought-prone regions. A report from the country's Vulnerability Assessment Committee estimates some 3.8 million people will not have enough to eat during this lean season.
Zimbabwe experiences a lean season every year. It's a dry period before the rain starts, from October, when many poor households sometimes run out of food stocks, to March, when harvesting begins, and that's if there isn't another drought.
It started raining in some parts of the country, but not out here. Saru Damu Nyangadzi is worried. If it doesn't rain, life for her family will get tougher.
We hope the donors will keep helping us, because if they stop coming, people could die here.
International aid agencies are working with Zimbabwe's government to feed millions of families. Climate change, rising food prices, and an inflation rate of more than 260% make things worse. Families will try to make their rations last at least 2 months, but with many mouths to feed, that may not be possible. Haru Matasa, Al Jazeera, Buhera, Zimbabwe.
There were rare protests in China too, but for very different reasons. People took to the streets to vent their frustration over almost 3 years of strict COVID controls. Infections have recently risen to a record high in the country, prompting more lockdowns. And that's despite a 20-point plan that was announced by the government earlier this month to try to ease coronavirus rules. The renewed curbs highlight once again the delicate balance that Beijing is trying to strike between easing its zero COVID policy to revive the economy and curb new outbreaks. Well, the potential for economic consequences were felt after angry protests broke at the world's biggest iPhone assembly plant in the city of Zhengzhou. Thousands of workers left the site after chronic food shortages, while the mass quarantining of employees depleted capacity on assembly lines. Apple warned that shipments of high-end iPhones would be lower than expected because of those disruptions. Well, around a quarter of China's total GDP has been affected by lockdowns after the recent rise in infections. The measures are expected to be a further drag on an already slowing economy. GDP grew by 3% in the third quarter, and that's far below the official target of around 5.5%. Factory activity fell for the second straight month in November, hitting a seven-month low. Many sectors saw overall profits decline in the first 10 months of the year. Exports and imports both unexpectedly declined in October. That's the first simultaneous slump since May 2020. Home sales in the top four cities fell more than 30% in the first 3 weeks of November. And car sales, which have been a bright spot for China's economy due to government subsidies, are also struggling. Well, there are now fears that problems caused by lockdowns and widening COVID infections could spill into global markets. To unpack all of this, we're joined now from Hong Kong by Carlos Casanova, senior economist at Asia Union Bancaire Privé, or UBP. Carlos, it's good to have you with us once again. China's zero COVID policy has not been sufficient to curb infections. China seems intent on persisting with it while the rest of the world opens up. Just how costly has it been to China's economy? Can China afford to keep on with its zero COVID policy?
The policy is costly on multiple fronts. In terms of GDP, we estimate that it could have cost China about 3 to 5% of GDP growth in 2022. So that is a significant amount. By that, I mean that in the absence of dynamic zero COVID, the Chinese economy could have grown at a pace of around 8% this year. So definitely something to consider. But of course, it's also costly in terms of social stability and the protests over the weekend, with tensions around some lockdowns in a few cities boiling over. It shows just how frustrated the population is with not being able to resume their normal lives and go back to work. And lastly, it's very costly also at local government level, because local governments are taxed with shouldering the cost of all of these regular PCR tests. And of course, for tier one cities or rich provinces, this is not an issue. But in smaller parts of the country, it is starting to become unsustainable, given that we have dwindling revenues from the housing sector slump and an increase in expenditures as a result of the requirement to do testing. So it's definitely not something that is sustainable going into 2023.
Now, the government has introduced a series of measures to try to prop up its slowing economy, including lowering the amount of cash that banks have to hold in reserve. Are these measures going to be enough to shore up household and business confidence there in China?
Well, the market seems to be pricing in some form of recovery. So they are definitely quite instrumental in at least signaling that the direction is correct. On the housing front, we saw 16 measures to support housing demand. They're quite broad-based, so they include everything from ensuring that developers have access to working capital to complete the pre-sold units that are currently delayed, to allowing local governments to lower down payment requirements for first-time homeowners. So this whole array of policies that have been put in place. On the COVID front, of course, there are 20 measures to try to reduce the impact of zero COVID on the economy. So we are not yet talking about full reopening. We're talking about restricting the impact of zero COVID on the economy. And so although both sets of measures constitute a step in the right direction, in our opinion, they will fall short. Because this reopening is a process, and it requires for the economy to be reopened for people to be able to move around, buy houses, and regain sentiment. So unfortunately, we are not quite there yet. But the measures announced in the last few weeks certainly point in the right direction. In the short term, we think they will have to lean on fiscal and monetary to try to wedge that gap.
And what impact is all of this having on China's international reputation? I'm talking in business terms here rather than political terms. A lot of multinational companies rely on China for their supply chains, and this spells potential disruption for them, doesn't it?
Well, there's a long-term trend around supply chain relocations out of China for a myriad of reasons, including higher costs, and other advantages in other manufacturing centers. The disruptions that many international companies have endured as a result of zero COVID only accelerates this tendency. And we have seen that very clearly, for example, in Zhengzhou, with the disruptions to the iPhone assembly plant run by Foxconn there. So it is a factor that international companies will have to consider. And I think it is going to weigh heavily on those board meetings when they discuss their China Plus One strategies going forward.
And what about the Chinese economic slowdown's impact upon other economies in the rest of the world, global markets? Is there anyone who would see a slowdown in China economically as a positive? Could it help other nations, or do you think it's something that could spark a general malaise across the world?
I think the latter. We really need China to reopen and pick up, or we will be in a global recession scenario in 2023. So currently our baseline is that we will experience, at least the region and many other exporters around the world will experience a decline in demand from Europe and North America as rising risks of recession start to crystallize in these regions. And so there's this hope that economic reopening in China will be able to pick up some slack from that decline in external demand from developed markets. So we really do hope that China can regain some momentum into next year. Of course, judging by the performance of some of the economic indicators this week, Q4 is still going to be very weak. So we are still in the midst of a recession per se in China. And that is going to continue to ebb on exports of countries that have exposure to demand. In particular in Asia, we see some downside risks in case it takes longer to reboot the Chinese economy. But given the direction that things are taking, with authorities being more keen on easing and also reducing some of the restrictions around COVID zero, we do think that it's possible that demand from China next year is going to help.
You say how long it will take to reboot the Chinese economy. What's the timescale we're talking about here?
So the reopening process is not a point in time. There is no one date, and after that, things are going to go back to normal. The reopening process is going to be a gradual theme for the entirety of 2023. And that entails there is going to be two-way volatility, both in terms of economic performance and, of course, for markets. Our understanding is that between now or the Communist Party Congress in October until March, which is the National People's Congress, it's a critical period in which they will try to reduce the economic impact and shift the narrative around COVID. They will start to reopen in March, hopefully, if vaccination rates amongst the elderly reach their threshold of 80%. We're currently at 60%, so still a little bit of a while to go. And also remember that there's 3 months between the first and the second dose. In many cases, given the lower efficacy of these vaccines, you need more than two doses to achieve immunity. So we are looking at a protracted process that will take the whole of next year to be completed. So it is going to be a gradual affair.
Always good to talk to you on Counting the Cost, Carlos. Many thanks indeed for being with us. Now, just a few years ago, flying cars were the stuff of science fiction. Today, though, a number of companies are building electrically powered aircraft that promise to make journeys faster and cleaner by rising above the traffic. Plans are underway to launch an air taxi service in Paris. It's hoped that the cabs will be in the skies in time for the 2024 Olympics. Natasha Butler went for a test flight.
At a purpose-built air terminal on the outskirts of Paris, a glimpse at what could be the future of taxi services. The German-built Volocopter is a vertical takeoff and landing drone that's big enough to carry passengers.
The idea is it'll be open to the full community. Anyone that wants to take an Uber today, there's no reason why they shouldn't contemplate taking a Volocity across across an urban landscape or across a city to get from A to B a lot quicker.
Paris Transport officials plan to have two operational Volocopter routes for the 2024 Olympics. As the aircraft are fully electric and quieter than a helicopter, they say that they're an ecological alternative to fuel-powered vehicles.
Well, it's certainly very comfortable and spacious here at the moment. There is room for a passenger and a pilot, but the manufacturer of Volocopter says that in the future, this service could be pilot-free.
Several cities in the world are testing similar aircraft as competition steps up in a potentially multi-billion dollar market.
Once we have started mass production, it will be definitely available for everyone. So also the fares will go down over time and we will definitely see it all over the world.
For now, fares are expected to be around $100 for a short ride, a price few ordinary people could afford.
Yes, I would say it's an ultra-niche market. Of course, you always have some rich people wanting to save some time. But I think it won't be the Uber of tomorrow, air taxi, definitely. It's for a target like this of customers.
It's unlikely that flying taxis will replace regular cabs anytime soon, but in a city where heavy traffic is common, some will certainly welcome the chance to skip the bottlenecks on the ground to gain precious time in the air.
Time for us to fly. That's our show for this week. If you'd like to comment on anything that you've seen, you can tweet me. I'm at A Finnegan on Twitter. Try to remember the hashtag AJCTC when you do tweet us. You can drop us a line. countingthecost@aljazeera.net is our email address. As always, there's plenty more for you online at aljazeera.com/CTC. That takes you straight to our page. And there you'll find individual reports, links, and entire episodes to catch up on. But that's it for this edition of Counting the Cost. I'm Adrian Finnegan. From the whole team here, thanks for being with us. The news on Al Jazeera is next.